Hey there. So this is the second episode of Dear Textiles, and I'm talking to Sigrun Bregadottir, a teacher, crafter, and craftivist from Reykjavik, Iceland. And we're talking about crafting and making and how it can be a force for healing and connection. I really enjoyed hearing her thoughts on how it's helped her, how making has helped her with her journey after trauma and being diagnosed with ADHD, and how she's using it all for a volcanic force for good. She mentions a solo craft show in the interview, which is already passed, but you can see photos from the show on her Instagram, which is at Sigrun Craftivist, which I'll link in the show notes. Thanks, Sigrun, for this interview, and I hope you all enjoy hearing about her work as much as I did. For everyone with imposter syndrome listening, I kept the first part of this episode in where I'm so nervous that my voice went up an octave and my dog started barking. This is my first go at editing audio, too, but since it's all a journey, here we go, keeping the imperfections and loving them, too. Thanks for listening.
All right. Hey, Sigrun.
Hi.
Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having
And
me.
for talking to me. And this is Sigrun Bregadottir. Do I have that right? Is that right?
Absolutely.
Okay. I grew up hearing Bjork being saying really fast Icelandic things, so I get a little freaked out. But first of all, you may hear my dog Sadie barking at neighbors in the background. She's not always very nice. But of course, she's doing that right now, the second. Okay, so we're gonna ignore her, maybe? That sounds good, right? We're all at home, and that's life in a pandemic. So first of all, tell me a little bit about yourself and how you started stitching and making things.
Yes, well, thank you for having me, Betsy. Well, like you said, my name is Sigrun and my last name is Bragadóttir. I live in Reykjavík, Iceland. I am almost 49 years old and I live here with my family. And I just can't remember myself in any other way than just always making stuff, doing stuff. I grew up surrounded by women sewing and knitting and embroidering, and my father and his father, my paternal grandfather, they were always, woodworking. And when I was a kid, I was drawing, sketching, mending things. And funny enough, I was more into woodworking than knitting and embroidering and such because I have ADHD, and all this precision and all this message about, like the front is supposed to be almost the back is supposed to be almost the same as the front because you were not supposed to see which way it goes because the how you what's it called when you stitch up when you are like finishing your project, it's supposed to be that good. And my great grandmother always scolded me about, this is the lazy woman's thread, she called it, when my embroidery thread was too long. And I mean, mind you, she was born in 1901, and her daughter, my grandmother and namesake, Sigrun, she was, grew up in the Depression and everything. So of course, their view was, be mindful of how you use the textile, the material you have. So my ADHD resistance is like, nope, this is not for me. I can't be bothered with this kind of stuff. And even when I was a child in elementary school, I needed help knitting, and the teacher said, like, no, you're a girl, you're supposed to know this.
the boys get all the help. And I was just so furious that I vowed to myself that I would never, ever knit again. And it was not until I was 33 years old that I began knitting again. And I was like, nope, no, sir. And but I've been cross-stitching now for a long time. I took that up again, despite my great-grandmother's words. And I love defying her words. I still think of her, though, and I respect her a lot. And I am thankful that she taught me how to cross-stitch when I was 14 years old.
Yeah, it's nice to have that kind of family connection. Mm-hmm. And
yeah.
I mean, the first thing I really learned about Iceland and craft was through Icelandic yarn. Mm-hmm. And that I always heard that it was really itchy. And so I didn't hear about how craft and making is perceived in Iceland, a lot about it, both now and historically. So can you tell me a little bit about how those things are perceived in Iceland, both historically and now?
Yes, crafting has always been perceived as a very common thing here in Iceland. And of course it varies nowadays that, because people come from all kinds of walks of life, and the funding at the elementary and the primary school has been cut down, this craft education. But so it really depends on, is there anyone in your family that really knows how to craft, like knit or whatever, so you can learn from them. But generally speaking, crafting is very common in Iceland, and it's perceived as a very, a natural thing that everyone is like knitting. For example, in the economy collapsed in 2008, almost everyone and their grandmother, began to knit again. And during this global pandemic, for the first time in a long time, wool is almost sold out in the stores because people are taking up knitting again.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there are many woodworking, and historically speaking in Iceland, our very existence was dependent upon people making stuff, because this is a very hard country. The forces of nature, like now, we have had over 34,000 earthquakes in over 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. 34,000. And we are expecting the volcano. Just, when I was doing this workshop earlier today, there was this 5.4 scale earthquake that hit the building, and it was like the building had been hit by a train, because I was situated so close to the origin of the earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
So and people are, and the weather is harsh, people had to build. And people had to use the wool and the skin, and people had to be constantly making things. And that has kept on living with the nation, in a sense that even though we are and we were more diverse than the actual, pop culture portray us, I bet like 100 years ago, when we were mostly farmers, old people and children were expected to deliver certain amount of mittens, socks, hats, and jumpers per week.
Mm-hmm.
So they were the ones that were not like healthy enough to work in the fields, or maybe they were too young to work in the fields and doing the traditional farm working. They had to knit.
Mm-hmm.
That was theirs. That was their share to the household. Right. So, and that was equally men and women, just old people in general, you know, they were knitting. So historically speaking, knitting, men knitting is not as common nowadays, but historically speaking, it's a short time in our history that men have not been, you know, knitting as much as they did before.
Right. And on the...
Am I making myself...
Yeah, and isn't it... Because yeah. I know when I was there, when I met you and Reykjavik, isn't there some spinning or something on the one of the bills the of money? Isn't there... Yeah. There's right. Yeah. And is it spinning? Yeah. I can't remember. So...
I can't remember either, but weaving, because women weaved the linen cloth for the sails, you know, when this was during the settlement times, and the clothes, and yes, our survival was mostly due to the sheep and the wool that came from the sheep that sustained us,
right.
Kept us from dying from cold. So they have been very resourceful using that wool, and yeah.
Yeah. So I met you when you shared a post on Instagram about the anthology that I edited that included the work of a lot of great people called Craftivism. Mm. And how did you find kind of, you know, the notion of craft and activism working together or craft and healing? Or how did you find kind of your way to that kind of like craft as a healing or as an activist methodology?
Mm-hmm. Well, it was through subversive cross-stitching.
Okay, Julie Jackson, yeah.
Julie Jackson, yes. Her Instagram and her website, where I first learned about, you know, that embroidery could be something fun, radical, subversive, and I bought a pattern from her, and then I began following her on Instagram, and that's where I saw your book. And I just realized for the first time then, I can't remember how many years ago, it's over 10 years ago that I bought this pattern from Julie Jackson, and I made a cushion that I began lifting that spell from my great-grandmother and my grandmother, because I thought that embroidering and stitching was so strict, and it was just I didn't want to follow the rules, because I had been obeying so many rules in my lifetime, unfair rules, as a child, you know, growing up in the 70s and the 80s, it was a strange time in Iceland. I mean, it was almost like children should be seen but not heard, kind of attitude towards children, and especially if you were a girl with ADHD, you know, I like to jump around in the bed just after my mom had made the bed. It was just so much more inviting, wasn't it?
Of course.
Exactly. And there was not a lot of television in those days in Iceland. And you know, but when we were watching the telly, maybe I wanted to jump in the sofa, not sitting in the sofa. So there was always these kind of rules that I had to follow. Some of them did not make any sense to me, but I was also acting out because I was also a traumatized child.
Right. Yeah.
So when I stumbled across embroidery that could be defying and funny, and you could say all kinds of things with, like, if you had the Gothic letters and the bright red Aida, the canvas, and gold thread. You could embroider profanity, and everyone was just like, "Wow, this is beautiful." Yes. Ooh, okay. Instead of, I would like stand on in the living room shouting these words, it would be like everyone would be like, "What happened?" This provoking in a courteous, mindful manner that really caught my heart. But because at that time, my trauma, which I had bottled down, was beginning to surface.
Right.
So finding the book you edited and seeing later on in my healing journey was so refreshing, because it gave me the confidence to go fully and more deeply into craftivism. I saw it as a healing tool. I saw it metaphorically. If I'm going, because my father was woodworking all the time and he had this toolkit, and my grandfather's tool shed was like a heaven for me. And he actually, you know, allowed me in there and showed me the tools and how to use them. And he told me their names, and I had to, you know, respectfully, you know, take care of them and whatnot. So I saw this so metaphorically. I had a toolkit, a box that I opened, and I could, like, when I'm putting up frames, you have to have a sturdy nail if the frame is heavy. And craftivism was one of those tools for me on my healing journey. Yeah. And I saw somewhere that stabbing a person once is, of course, that's bad, but, you know, stabbing a canvas 100 times is much healthier.
Was that Shannon Downey's piece? It's a big round piece. So, but you have your own Icelandic hashtag for craft activism, and what is it? And what does it mean to you? And what are your hopes for it?
My hashtag is #HannirðaPunk, and that is a word made from three words: crafts, handverk, hannirðir, og punk. Crafts is a general word in English, but we have several words for that in Icelandic, depending on the general term that contains, you know, like woodworking, you know, knitting and embroidering and crochet and whatnot. But hannirðir is more textile related.
Okay.
So I wanted to include these two words, handverk and hannirðir, and of course then I had the hannirðir, that was, you know, I could use that for both. And punk is a verb also in Icelandic that you can use when you are trying to activate something. You're trying to activate either a person or a notion. You are trying to change something for good, you know, for a good cause. And I loved punk when I was a child. Oh my God.
Yes.
I loved those punk rockers, the clothes, the power, everything. And I loved what the activist aspect of it, that, you know, you didn't have to ask for permission. You were defining gender roles, gender norms, fashion. There was just so much radical undercurrent after the war, and it's in this Cold War era, that you know, the lower classes were trying to take back their power, to be seen, to be heard, to take up space without asking the upper classes for permission.
Right.
So in my my thought with combining these three words, it's a loose translation of the word craftivism, because there you combine craft and activism. Mm-hmm. Because we don't have an Icelandic translation, a good translation for activism. We say aktivismi, aktivismi, mm-hmm. we say in Icelandic, but people tend to connect that with people, you know, breaking stuff, lighting stuff on fire, or, you know, smashing things. Mm-hmm. But as I understand it, activism has a more general understanding in the English language than it's not just, you know, rioters.
Yeah.
I
mean, it definitely is that it can be perceived as a negative force, but it can definitely be a positive force to move things towards good.
Exactly.
And you know, things that are fairer and more equitable, and because mm-hmm. so many voices haven't been heard or brought to the table. And so that's great. So I know that we've talked a lot about how empowering making things has been for mm-hmm. each of us after our own individual experiences of assault and interpersonal mm-hmm. violence. And can you share how craft and textiles in particular have aided in your own healing?
Yes, textile and crafts have made a huge impact in my healing process, because when I'm working with my hands, my brain has a day off, in a sense that the chatter, the constant chatter in both the ADHD brain but also the traumatized brain, the amygdala is always trying to take control, you know, trying to convince us of things that are not true. And even when we are just having a normal day and something very irrelevant goes wrong, I have tried to convince myself that if the Pope gets pregnant, it's my fault.
Right.
You know, I'm ready to take on the blame for the world.
Even though he's in Italy and you're in Iceland. It's totally your fault.
Yes. What I've learned is that when we are working with our hands, the amygdala is cut off in a way, because the frontal lobe is more active. And when the frontal lobe is more active, it's like a shipping bridge, because, you know, it opens up, it disconnects to the amygdala. So we get the chatter is cut off, and we are rested, and our stress hormones get lowered, even the blood sugar is lowered, hypertension is, you know, high blood pressure, it decreases. It's such a healthy, powerful way in its very own soft, delicate existence. Mm-hmm. It helps me to embrace the moment in a way, and how I can create. For example, when I'm angry, I can embroider something. I can embroider profanity, and I can just leave it in the drawer. I don't have to do anything with it, instead of just shouting it from the balcony of my house. I mean, of course, it's healthy also to phrase your anger and put your anger and emotions into words, but sometimes we cannot do that, because we have to take our family into consideration. We just cannot be rolling over them when we are, you know, having a moment, and that's when, you know, embroidery is, for example, a heaven sent.
Yeah, and the amygdala, if anyone doesn't know, is the part of your brain that that lets you know that, like, you're in danger. And if you have a history of assault, for me, it's, you know, it's anything. It's like any strange noise. I have grew up after I was assaulted in my early 20s with a very, very strong sense of hyper arousal. So any noise was like, I'm going to die. My brain went, you're going to die, hide.
So when
I found yarn and stitching, I remember touching it and it felt safe. It felt like it wasn't going to hurt me. It felt good. I could relax. And so it was life changing for me because I could sit with something and I could experiment and I could play. And I wasn't, my brain wasn't like, you're going to die. it was like you're creating, this is exciting. And it was so exciting because I could create safely and then share it. And then, and and so the fact that it can kind of help your brain calm down is and give it your brain something else to think about.
Exactly.
And the fact that you, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. Sorry. No, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. No, but I was just going to say, like you said, like touching the textile, the different texture of the canvas or the yarn or the embroidery thread. It's a sensory, it's a powerful tool to help us come back from, for example, disassociation periods, because it's very normal for people who are having a sensory overload to disassociate. But touching the textile is a way for us to come back. We don't have to escape.
Yeah, it's nice. You can show up with your yarn, and that's with the people that you're making with. And you don't always have to talk when you're making. You can and so you can have difficult conversations that or no conversation and just be there in silence. And that was such a safe space. So in your kind of journey with that, like what has been the most unexpected part of working with yarn and textiles?
I think the most unexpected thing is the physical cure that it has had on my life as well. We talked about the amygdala, the ancient part of the brain that has almost not developed since we were like in the beginning of time, and I can just feel how my body, when my body is all tensed up and I take time for myself to craft, that it really has helped with my physical health as well. Because when people are traumatized, it's not just their mental health that is on the line, it's also our physical health. Because like I said, our hormones go, haywire. Yeah. Our blood sugars tend to rise even though we're not eating sweets. And our blood blood pressure tends to get higher even though we're not even drinking coffee. They're just because our body is always in a constant state of fight or freeze or play dead. So that is the most unexpected thing, that having fun could also help my body to heal, not just my emotions or my mind. But the second unexpected thing is that how many people are catching on to how crafting can really help, and it doesn't have to be perfect, and you don't have to have the backside, for example, of the embroidery so perfectly finished that no one can tell which side is which. It's just it's the actual process of doing something with your hands that helps you see things differently, the environment, yourself, your body, and also that many people have been doing this for centuries.
Right.
And craftivism, and my loose translation of it as in Hannah the Pink, it is nothing new. But it's so much fun, you know, being able to point out under that, you know, this concept of craftivism, that what people are doing is helping themselves and helping the greater good. Right. Because many people tend to look down upon, you know, knitting and crochet because it's like granny style, you know, do what grandmothers do, as in being a grandmother, something degrading. I mean, come on.
No, definitely.
And I don't know how it is in the United States, but here in Iceland, it's a very conservative, what you could say, not society, but like, it's you don't mess up with the hardanger embroidery.
Right.
it's a huge no-no.
Right.
Hardanger is hardanger, and you do not try to make a sugar skull out of with hardanger stitches.
Right. No.
It's like a treason.
Yeah.
But that way, that is a perfect way for having a traditional folk art die out when you're not introducing it to the younger generation through fun. But when you introduce it to the younger generation under the name of craftivism, mm-hmm. they catch on. And of course, I know that, you know, you really have to be mindful of how you hide the thread when you are knitting a jumper, a sweater, if you want it to last. But right. that is not the first thing you introduce to a young person who is trying her way out in this. Because when they catch on, when they find out where their enthusiasm lies, they go all in and they end up having a thing that is valuable to them, and therefore they try to make it last as long as possible. But you know, preaching about like how you finish off your product before you even introduce how to, you know, thread a needle,
right.
it kills the interest. But there are so many young people catching on and finding craftivism, and they are just enlightened, like, wow, can I even do this like this? Like, yes, yeah. I mean, just have fun.
Yeah.
Just out.
So that's the most unexpected kind of part of everything. What is the best? What is the best part? Like,
the best part is that there are so many people starting to use the hashtag #HannaThePink.
Yay!
So I had a talk with the textile. I don't know what it's called in English, but it's like a union of textile teachers.
Uh-huh.
And I gave a speech at their Christmas gathering before COVID.
Uh-huh.
And they were mostly the older women were, of course, very skeptical. Why connecting this to punk, and why, you know, like I told you, it's like, what do you think about when you think of punk? Do you picture a person, you know, sniffing glue with a mohawk, or do you see or do you see the social activism that people were trying to make a change? They were trying to make their voices heard. It doesn't matter what you call it. It's just the only thing that matters is what you do. There were so many teachers, you know, had their minds changed about how they look at textile and crafting. And I have seen on at least one elementary school's website that where they used the word #HannaThePink as in craftivism for their
nice.
Work.
So,
yes.
Yeah. And I think that it's important in situations. I don't know about you, but I silenced myself in a bajillion ways
mm-hmm.
for decades because I was scared that if I said what happened to me, I would get hurt again. If yeah. I said what happened to me, somebody would tell me they didn't believe me, which actually mm-hmm. happened, but, yeah. and I didn't die. And, and people did believe me. Yes. And I think that people and the thought that I wasn't a good person because something bad happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, well, I don't deserve good things. And so I just mm-hmm. kind of tore myself up yeah. and then found such a freedom in craft.
Mm-hmm.
And then also have, you know, been wondering how other people can use craft as a way to find their own voice mm-hmm. and absolutely. Their own strength.
Absolutely.
Because it's, and you don't even necessarily realize that you're silencing yourself. And then, but by being able to stitch something and to break so-called rules that you may have learned yeah. when you were yeah. a kid is mm-hmm. very amazing. And to be able to yeah. make something of your own choice yeah. versus what's, yeah, it's amazing. So mm-hmm. you have a solo show coming up, yes. And where is it? And what are you making now for it?
Thank you. Yes, it is in a town up north called Akureyri. It's called mm-hmm. the capital of the north. It's mm-hmm. just close to the Arctic Circle. So in May, it'll be 24 hours daylight there.
Wow.
And even we might even have midnight sun. So mm-hmm. I look so much forward to spending time there in May. I've usually been there in like the late summer. And then right. the nights are, you know, bright. And because we are so close to the Arctic Circle, it'll be like no light compares to the Arctic light.
Yeah. But yes,
It's in a small gallery called Cactus Gallery, and it's a part of the Akureyri Art Museum. It's in mm-hmm. the same building, and I am now currently renovating a French chair.
Mm-hmm.
It's a thrift store find, and I am polishing it, and I'm gonna paint it black with a paint that absorbs the 99% of light.
Mm-hmm.
So you won't, it looks almost dimensional, two-dimensional, sorry, okay. not three-dimensional as we perceive, the human eye perceives things. And I am embroidering the seat and the back and the arms with a second-hand embroidery. And I'm filling it up with a bright pink nylon thread.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, it's like a rose pattern. And in that, I'm gonna write over it, as one can say, I'm going to embroider with human hair.
Okay, wow.
And I'm gonna embroider words that women were, you know, how can I say it in English? I asked on Twitter and Facebook if women or people who were brought up as girls,
mm-hmm.
What words they heard before the age of 12, words that were used about their gender or their genitalia.
Right.
And there is a shock factor, of course, because there are very crude, cruel words to say to a young girl under the age of 12.
Yeah.
But I'm going to embroider that in the chair, in the seat and in the back with human hair.
Wow.
And the hair, I rinse it in egg yolk and cold water.
Mm-hmm.
And I work it according to an ancient Chinese method from late imperial China. It's very, very exciting.
That sounds fantastic. So yeah. you have that coming up. And then what would you like to do after you finish that project? Anything in particular?
Yes. Well, let me tell you that the chair is not the only thing that I'll be having, but I'm also I have other pieces, thrift store finds that I buy, and mm-hmm. I embroider words it's like yarn graffiti.
Okay.
Almost yarn graffiti over old embroidery. So, but yeah, mm-hmm. what I'm the upcoming times are pretty exciting as well, because I've just decided to apply for a master's in the Teachers University. I'm going to be a master of teaching in the visual art department.
Wow!
Yes! I'm so happy to share this with you because I had a meeting with the dean last week, and I was going to apply for the textile department. Mm-hmm. And she said that after looking at my website, she said, maybe you should look into also the visual art department, because I feel as if textile is your medium. Yarn is your medium, but you have so much more to bring to the table in a wider concept.
Right. Yeah. That's fantastic.
So, yeah, I am very excited about that as well. So I'm also working on making patterns to go and sell online.
Nice.
So yeah, I have a few things brewing.
I think that when people talk about craft and healing and growing and trauma and stuff like that, I think that there are a lot of resources out there that you and I have talked about privately about, like different books that have been helpful in kind of working with craft as a healing modality. I know that for me, The Body Keeps the Score was really helpful. And also the work of Peter Levine, who did Waking the Tiger. And I'm just thinking about if there's anything that you've read, any books that have, or websites. There was that book that you recommended to me that was a project that was free online that was about assault and healing. That one was really good.
Nina Burrow's book.
That one.
Help me to wake up from a Cinderella's sleep. I can't remember the name. Can you remember? Oh my God, that's awkward. It's really awkward.
The Courage to Be Me.
The Courage to Be Me. The Courage to Be Me. That has been the toughest project of them all. The Courage to Be Me. And that is really helping me. And the book that you added it, the anthology, Craftivism.
Oh, thanks. And
also Sarah Corbett's book, The Gentle Protest. And I am, The Body Keeps the Score was mind-blowing.
It is. It's really, it's amazing. I have like that on my Kindle, and I have highlighted so many parts of that, because he talks about, because I think also tangentially you have the kind of healing and moving part, like yoga and mindfulness and there's all these different things that that kind of work their way into healing, and I think that it's important to talk about.
It is. And Christine Neff's mindfulness, self-compassion, mindfulness meditation. Mm-hmm. I use that quite a lot. And Gabor Mate, I've been looking into his videos on YouTube. Mm-hmm. He is a psychiatrist who was traumatized during the Second World War. And he has been talking about a lot about trauma and addiction, and also not in the conventional way that we see addiction, but also like addictive to feelings. Mm-hmm. I realized that I had been, for example, addictive to stress.
Yeah.
Because I used stress as my driving power when I was just so numb due to my trauma that I could hardly move. So I procrastinated a long time. And then when I felt I had enough energy, it was like a boom blast. And then I went off. But that was not a good way to roll because, of course, I burnt out. I'm an educated teacher and I am. And due to several circumstances, I, you know, went on a sick leave because I just burnt out.
I was addicted to other people's drama for a long time because I didn't have to think about my own stuff.
Absolutely.
And so other people's life being chaos was like, oh, well, I let me fix that. And I don't have to fix myself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Wow. And now I'm looking into shame a lot because, shame was just a very common method for bringing up kids in Iceland when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. Shame on you. You should be ashamed of yourself. Aren't you ashamed? Aren't you ashamed? You are shameless. Always this shame and also shifting shame and blame.
Right.
And I don't know, there's a psychiatrist that says the majority of Icelanders have ADHD. That's why we survived here on this funky island up in the north. Okay. So maybe that was the only way our parents could restrain their children because they were always going berserk anyway. So, but that was just a funny way of looking at difficult things. But I think shame has so much to do with how we deal with trauma because it has been studied that survivors of sexual assault often put shame in first place of consequences of being assaulted or, you know, the effects of being assaulted. They feel more shame than anger because we shame ourselves into believing that somehow this was our fault because the brain cannot handle, you know, in that the world can be such an ugly place. I'm cooking it down and putting it mildly, but this is just, you know, when the initial shock hits, it's just a way of denying the current situation in order to survive.
Yeah, it's easier to ignore. Mm-hmm. And so, but that's why craft was such a saving grace because I could be angry with it or sad. Absolutely. Or just not know what I was feeling. And then, but I was still making something. So then it was like, I couldn't tell myself that I was useless because I was making something. And then, you know, as I was coming up with ideas about what I wanted to talk about, after kind of coming out of years of therapy and doing more public stuff, then I stopped making because then I felt ashamed. I was like, oh, I'm going to share what happened to me. That's going to be scary. Oh my gosh. Like, must be quiet. And then you start making stuff and then you're like, oh, I forget. Like, this is actually part of my power is making stuff. And that can go into, and I think it's also important to realize that it's not necessarily just craft. Like, it could be anything. Mm-hmm. It could be cooking. Okay. It could be anything where you're creating something by making something that, you know, that like everyone else on the pandemic, I got really into making bread and I found that I would have a stressful day at work. And then I would just like, I have to make something and I wasn't stitching. So I would make bread. Mm-hmm. And but seeing yourself create something is such a healing thing.
Yes. And there is this saying in Icelandic, hugur and hönd. It means like the mind and the hands. When they work together, magic happens. Because when we are working with our hands, it's a metaphor for creating, because not being ableist, I mean, not everyone can make good use of their hands, but everyone can make in one way or the other. As long as we are surviving, we can make. We can. Creating is not about showing off a final product. It's like when you put your mind into a different kind of mode and you think on a different level than, you know, just on autopilot every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think also, I don't know why I haven't thought about it until just this now, but thank you for talking. But I also think that making helps, because I freeze when anything traumatic has happened to me. I freeze. And then that brings a lot of shame, because why didn't you do something? Why didn't you act out? My body was like, we're just trying to keep you alive. Like,
yep.
We're just trying to do our job here. That's all. Yes. That's why we're here. We're here to keep you alive. So, but I was like, well, you know, you should have fought back. You should have said something. Mm-hmm. And so there's so much shame in that, mm-hmm. but the act of making something is a safe way to work myself out of freezing.
Yes.
And so when I am not making something, I stay in kind of freeze mode.
Yeah.
And then I make something, and then it's like, I can kind of ease out of a freeze state.
Yeah.
Which is kind of freeze. A low level. It's not like I'm like, you know, I can walk around and stuff, but I'm not making something. I'm still kind of frozen and scared from
absolutely
doing something positive.
Because when we freeze, we are disassociating.
Right.
And we can be driving a car, you know, from one end of the country to the other. And when we arrive at our destination, we are like, whoa, how did I get here safely? Because our mind was completely elsewhere.
Yeah. So that's making one
form of disassociating. Yeah.
Yeah. It definitely keeps me present. And I know it's mindful and keeps me there.
And we just have to face it that we are just mammals. We are mammals. And we, when under difficult situations, we do not react with our frontal lobe, where our rational thinking is. We react like every other mammal with our amygdala. And our amygdala just decides if we should fight, if we should flee, as in flight, or freeze, as in play dead. Like possums have so miraculously developed that they can play dead for an hour. No heartbeat, no breath, no pulse, nothing for an hour, because they know that the predator doesn't want a prey that has been dead for a while, because that means disease, that means that the risk of their own survival. So they leave the possums be. I mean, that if that is not genius, I don't know what it is. That only shows that this is a way of fighting. But we just don't, you know, we don't, you know, collapse to the ground. You know, usually many people do that. But, you know, like I said, we could be walking, but we could be playing dead inside just to survive. This is, and it's all about how we come back from, you know, disassociating like that. And we can come back through textile by touching the soft wool or the silk or even the acrylic, because acrylic can be soft, but it can also be like squeaky. But that also, you know, but that can also raise reactions in ourselves. So it's just about coming back to our bodies, coming back to our minds, landing again in ourselves, having the courage to be ourselves. However we, you know, find that courage. But I mean, textile and craftivism is just a heaven sent. When I discovered this word craftivism for the first time, I was so curious. But it was just like having a glass of water after running a mile. And when I began looking more and more into it, it just breathed life into me. It gave me courage to fight back in a way that I had not thought that I could do using this medium that has been so looked down upon. So because it's feminine, it takes time, it's delicate, and therefore it must be so boring and dull. But I mean, embroidery, when you like I said, with beautiful a beautiful alphabet and beautiful yarn, something really shocking, it delivers the message in a way that people have to listen, but it does not provoke anger or resistance or shut off as it would do if you would smash their cars or shout something in their face or say, I am here, this has happened to me. And people just have to take it in, but they take it on their own terms. We are not forcing it upon them.
I mean, and there is definitely a place for anger, and I understand people's angers for sure. And but I think it depends that everybody's response is going to be different. And so I think what's important is just to show up in a way that works for you, and that may be a totally different way that no one has ever thought about, which is the coolest part, because you, because it can be a way, it's unique to what your skills are, what your background is, what, like, cause I'm always super excited that when I hear people talk about how they're using their skills, their histories, their family's histories to talk about craft and how it's creating a better world is super exciting, because we need all the stories to get as many people involved in making the world better as possible.
Oh, yes.
And there's a lot of ways.
There are so many ways. And this, I love this word, the gentle protest.
Because not Sarah Corbett.
And not everything has to be done by force. And because when we force things to happen, we're often straining ourselves. We are straining others. We are straining and draining ourselves and others in a way that it's more difficult to return from that place when we are so strained and drained that we only thing we can do is breathe.
I think it's important, I think, to think about what is the most nourishing for you in a way that punches up and not down and up.
Exactly.
And that's important.
So one day we can be so angry with the world that we just want to, you know, snap, but we cannot allow ourselves that due to so and so many reasons. And the other day we're just, you know, so happy that we want to share the joy with the world. So even though we do something out of anger one day, it is better to do it with some kind of textile than to do something rash and then regret it later, because, you know, feelings are feelings. They are not investments. They just come and they go. And sometimes and we don't have any wrong feelings, and our feelings aren't wrong in a sense that they're just feelings, but sometimes they do not interpret the current reality. They are maybe words from the past trauma, and that's why it's so marvelous to, you know, be able to do it by creating.
And everybody has their own spin and their own history. And that's what's great about craft, is because we all learned in different ways of how to make things. So we all have different skills. And that's great. So thank you for talking to me about crafts and trauma and healing and growing and all that kind of stuff.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for asking me. I really enjoyed it. I hope my English was, you know, I hope I made myself understandable.
A lot better than my Icelandic, that's for sure, which doesn't exist.
So you made it to the end of this first interview with someone else on the second episode. Gosh, thank you so much. Really, your time is important and I appreciate it. So thanks for listening. And you can find out more about Sigrun in the show notes accompanying this post and at Sigrun Craftivist on Instagram and on her website, sigruncraftivist.com. If you'd like to hear future episodes, which will be out every other week, you can subscribe to Dear Textiles on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, of course, right? Spotify, Anchor, and elsewhere. Follow me on social media at Craftivista and sign up for my newsletter, which also comes out every 2 weeks, either at the link in my social media bios or at deartextiles.com. Thanks for being here. Thanks for your time and for believing that we all have the power to make the world a better place.